Shalom Adabarnix. Welcome again to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and the History of the Modern State of Israel. We're in session 21 at this time. Again, still dealing with Israel present. So let's go ahead and do our review of our previous session. The previous session began in the year 2000 with the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. We also saw that there was a lot of media bias present when reporting the Israeli-Arab conflict, and that was highlighted by this picture of an Israeli policeman and a so-called Palestinian on the Temple Mount. Well, the bloodied so-called Palestinian happened to be a young Jewish man, and he wasn't on the Temple Mount. He's in front of a gas station, as you can see there. He had been attacked by a mob of Arab people pulled out of a taxi and attacked. Two Israeli reservists were lynched in Ramallah, which made world headlines, this picture. The Sharm el-Sheikh summit convened in October 2000. We explored the youthful face of the Intifada, the fact that the Palestinian Authority and others were recruiting children to fight in the demonstrations. November 2000, Israel began to target terrorists. In November, an international inquiry met to examine the Intifada and determine why it occurred and solutions for the future. Heard this before. Ariel Sharon became the new Prime Minister of Israel. On May 14, 2001, we now move into 2001, Israel's 53rd Independence Day, 53rd birthday. The Jewish population was 5.2 million, the Arab population about 1.0 million, the total population, of course, 6.2. So the nation has really grown over the years. In April, the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, had hit its lowest level ever, getting very, very close to the black line. If the water level ever falls below the black line, the lake could become polluted. And the Sea of Galilee is Israel's largest reservoir, fresh water source, so it's very important. On May 4th, 2001, the Mitchell Report was issued, and here are the recommendations in regard to the Intifada, in regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. One, cease the violence. Two, resume security cooperation. Three, rebuild confidence. And four, resume negotiations. CIA Director George Tenet was sent to the Middle East to convince Yasser Arafat to follow through on the Mitchell Report and its findings. September 11, 2001, when Islamic terrorists attacked the United States, destroying the Twin Towers and flying a plane into the Pentagon. Israel reacted with sympathy and support because the Israelis know exactly what it feels like to be under the thumb of terrorism, under the attack of terrorism. Rehavam Zvi, the tourist minister in the government, was assassinated. General Anthony Zinni was sent to the Middle East again to convince Arafat to follow through with the recommendations of the Tenet Plan. He was unsuccessful. At the end of December, Israel severed ties to Arafat, calling him irrelevant. And in 2001 was considered the most difficult year ever for Israel's security. Most difficult year ever in its short history for security. This brings us to the new material as we move into the year 2002. We begin with the Karain A Palestinian freighter captured. Israeli commandos seized the PA-owned freighter Karain A, capturing 50 tons of weapons destined for the Palestinian Authority. The ship was owned by the PA and commanded by a PA naval officer. The weapons were valued at $15 million. They included long-range missiles, mortars, mines, and advanced explosives. And here's a picture of the Karain A weapons all laid out in nice, neat rows for the world to see. 50 tons of weapons, $15 million worth. Now, the PA, the key point is that the PA is not permitted to have these weapons under the peace accords that they had signed with Israel. So this is a direct violation of that peace agreement they had entered into. The captain of the ship, Omar Akawi, admitted the arms were headed for the Palestinian Authority. He was told to deliver the arms off the coast of Gaza. Secretary of State Colin Powell called Yasser Arafat and demanded an urgent and full explanation. Vice President Cheney stated that it was clear that Arafat or people very close to him were involved in this arms smuggling attempt. So caught red-handed, the Palestinian Authority denied any involvement. Yasser Arafat's own words on February 1, 2002, 1 month after the interception, "We have no connection with the weapon ship. It's all a PR trick by the Israeli Mossad." It's always the Mossad, isn't it? It's always a PR trick, and it's always done by the Mossad, isn't it? "In the storehouse, I have enough weapons, much more than was on that ship." So he kind of boasted of having plenty of arms. Well, Israel continues to confine Arafat to his Ramallah headquarters. Israel has imposed a travel ban on Yasser Arafat until he arrests the killers of Israeli Cabinet Minister Rahavam Zvi. Cabinet Minister Zvi was assassinated in the fall of 2001. The first hints of the U.S. severing ties with Arafat surfaced with the disclosure that the Bush administration is considering sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. Arafat ordered the arrest of PFLP leader Ahmed Saadat. And here's Ahmed Saadat. He ordered the arrest of Ahmed Saadat in connection with the killing of cabinet member Zvi because the PFLP claimed responsibility for Zvi's assassination. The PFLP reacted with the threat to kill Palestinian security chiefs unless Saadat was released. They claim that Arafat had buckled under to Israeli and American dictates. January 20th, 2002, the first woman suicide bomber. A 28-year-old Palestinian medic, Wafa Idris, was the first woman to ever carry out a suicide mission. Her mother called her a hero and a martyr. And here is Wafa Idris with her mother. Now, it's forbidden under Islamic law for a woman to commit suicide for any reason. She was not religious. She did not pray. But the attack set new security standards for Israel. Now, every Palestinian man, woman, and child is a potential suspect. Now, while Islamic theology promises extravagant rewards to male martyrs, it's not so clear what promises are made to female suicide bombers. Now, Merit, on June 5, 2002, reported that the two female suicide bombers to date were both divorced, both shunned by their families, and both felt their lives were over anyway. So they were recruited as a way of bringing honor to themselves after disgracing their families. Not exactly the type of culture that I would like to embrace. February 3, 2002, the northern border grows warmer. Israeli Foreign Minister Peres asserted that Iran had supplied Hezbollah militants in Lebanon with 8,000 missiles that could hit Israeli cities. He warned Lebanon that Israel would not tolerate missile attacks from Lebanese territory. February 2, 2002, Qassam-2 missiles seized and launched. The IDF seized 8 Qassam-2 missiles. Now here's a photograph of a Qassam-2 missile with some launchers, so it's ready to go. So they seized 8 Qassam-2 missiles on a truck traveling from Nablus to Jenin in the West Bank. So the missiles have a range of 6 or 7 miles, and they're capable of hitting Israel's densely populated coastline. If they're used, it would be a dramatic escalation in the violence. On February 10, 2002, the Palestinians launched 2 Qassam-2 missiles on Israel. This was the first launch of such rockets at Israeli targets. The rockets landed at Kibbutz Sa'ad and Moshav Shuva without causing injury or damage. Subsequent operations by the IDF were taken to prevent Qassam-2s from hitting Israel. Now on February 17, 2002, 2 more upgraded Qassam-2s landed at Kfar Azza, but without any injury. February 14, 2002, ambulances and medical vehicles are used by terrorists. Terrorists are making more and more use of ambulances and medical vehicles. They are working on the premise that these vehicles do not undergo thorough examinations when passing through IDF checkpoints. The first woman bomber, Wafa Idris, apparently was transported in this manner using a Red Crescent ambulance. She was a medical secretary for the Palestinian Red Crescent. Ambulance drivers, because they had relatively easy movement around the West Bank, have served as messengers for Hamas. Accordingly, Israel tightened up security checks on all medical vehicles. On April 1, 2002, a Red Crescent ambulance was found carrying a bomb. The bomb was hidden underneath a gurney. On the gurney lay a sick Palestinian child. It was removed from the ambulance and detonated in the presence of representatives of the International Red Cross. The driver confessed that he tried to smuggle the bomb in and that it was not the first time that ambulances had been used to transfer terrorists or bombs. For example, at the end of June 2002, IDF soldiers stopped two Palestinian ambulances for a routine check and found 27 people packed inside them. 10 of these were men who were suspected of involvement in shooting or bomb attacks. So the use of ambulances in this manner is a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. But of course, the PA doesn't really care too much about the Geneva Convention. March 11, 2002, Israel lifts Arafat's detention. Arafat met a key Israeli demand after 3 months of defiant resistance. Palestinian police arrested all five terrorists wanted for the assassination of Israeli Cabinet Minister Rahavam Zvi. Arafat is free to travel in PA areas, but will have to ask permission to travel abroad. March 13, 2002, the UN Security Council endorses a Palestinian state. The UN Security Council, and here's a picture of the Security Council in session, the UN Security Council passed a resolution endorsing the creation of a Palestinian state for the first time and called for an immediate ceasefire. The United States introduced the resolution, which was approved by 14 of the 15 members. Syria abstained. The Palestinians welcomed the resolution. Israel stated that if such a state is demilitarized, created through negotiations, and would live at peace with its neighbors, Israel would accept it. Minister of Foreign Affairs Peres stated, "Israel is a party to the desire to achieve an immediate ceasefire through the implementation of the Mitchell and Tenet plans in order to pave the way toward a renewal of the peace process and a return to the negotiating table." March 28, 2002 is also the date of Passover 2002, where a suicide bomber kills 22 in Netanya. Now, Netanya is located on the coast in the center of the country. You can see the box on the left and then the enlarged box on the right. And here's Netanya, a pretty little seaport, seacoast town in the middle of the country. A 25-year-old Palestinian terrorist aligned with Hamas walked into the dining room of the Park Hotel in Netanya, where 250 guests were beginning their Passover Seder, and detonated himself. He was disguised as a woman and had slipped by the guards. And here is the Park Hotel where this bombing occurred in Netanya. The blast led to the deaths of 29 people and injured 140. Then the attack became known as the Passover Massacre. The next day, Arafat announced that he's ready to work toward an immediate ceasefire. He said he was willing to unconditionally implement the Tenet Plan and the Mitchell Report. And then he went on to say, "Unfortunately, there are some aggressive preparations by Israelis to do with a wide military operation against our civilians, targeting our people and our Palestinian Authority." So he's got pressure. He realizes something is up, and the pressure causes him to make a decision. Well, just a quick update on the Passover Massacre. The date here is 2003, 4/14/2003. All four members of the Hamas cell responsible for the Park Hotel attack in Netanya, known now as the Passover Massacre, were sentenced by a military court to 29 life sentences, one for every life that they took. All right, this would be a good time for you to view the video, the DVD, Israel in a Time of Terror by Dennis Prager, 60-minute video dealing with this very, very difficult time in Israel's history. It's available on Amazon.com. Well, March 29, 2002, Operation Protective Wall, Defensive Shield begins. On March 29th, Prime Minister Sharon announced an extensive operational activity against Palestinian terrorism had commenced. The action was known as Operation Protective Wall, also became known as Operation Defensive Shield. The goals, number one, to crack down on terror. Number two, to destroy terrorist infrastructure. Number three, to confiscate weapons. And number four, to arrest fugitives. It extended from March 28th, 2002 until April 19th, 2002. Now, the IDF cornered a defiant Arafat in his Ramallah compound, blasted their way inside, and began a room-by-room search using small arms fire and stun grenades. And this is a newspaper article, newspaper picture of Yasser Arafat's compound being breached by the IDF. The operation yielded documents that directly linked Arafat to Palestinian suicide bombings. Control of the entire compound was seized except for the floor of the building where Arafat lives. The army was instructed to isolate him, but not to take over his offices. Arafat used the opportunity to grant interviews with Arabic language television stations. He stated he wanted to become a martyr. Well, here's a cartoon by Michael Ramirez of in regard to this statement. Here in the center of the cartoon is Yasser Arafat, and he says, "I hope God will make me a martyr." And then his next statement, "Send in another woman or child to take my place." Good insights by Michael Ramirez. During the operation, over 500 Palestinian men were detained for identification and questioning. Large stores of weapons and arms were discovered in Arafat's compound in the Ramallah. And here's the West Bank, and Ramallah is located here in the West Bank. The weapons were being held by the PA in direct violation of all agreements made with Israel. 10 terrorists on Israel's most wanted list were arrested during the operation in the Ramallah. The next week, Operation Protective Wall was widened with IDF movements into, here's the Ramallah, into Qalqiyah, Nablus, Jenin, Tukaram, and Bethlehem. During the entire operation, 4,258 Palestinians were detained, 396 wanted suspects arrested. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon addressed the nation, and he said that Israel is at war on terror. We must fight this terrorism, fight it with no compromise. Pull up these wild plants by the roots. Smash their infrastructure, because there is no compromise with terrorism. This terrorism is used, directed, and initiated by one man, Yasser Arafat. And I must agree, Ariel Sharon hit it right on the nose with that statement. Arafat remained confined to his windowless office, with Israel supplying food, medicine, and water to Arafat and the people confined with him. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres stated that Israel had to achieve the goals that Arafat was supposed to accomplish. Palestinian leaders said that Operation Protective Wall was simply a pretext to kill Arafat. PA leaders even claimed that the IDF was planning to storm Arafat's headquarters in an attempt to snatch the wanted men and possibly send Arafat into exile. U.S. envoy Anthony Zinni met with Arafat in his Ramallah office. He told Zinni that he supported the tenant plan. However, Arafat has agreed to the tenant plan time and time and time again and has never implemented it. Arafat's pattern is to never make a major decision unless under extreme pressure. On April 4, 2002, Sharon announced that the IDF would not lift the siege on Arafat until he handed over three of the alleged killers of Rahavam, cabinet member Rahavam Zvi. After 34 days of confinement, the siege was lifted when Arafat agreed to a U.S. compromise ending the confinement. Under the agreement, six terrorists, including the convicted killers of Cabinet Minister Zvi, will be jailed in Jericho under American and British supervision. Israel stated that the assassins were with Arafat in the compound. After leaving his compound, Arafat toured the areas hit by Operation Defensive Shield. It's notable that he visited the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin, During the operation, 48 terrorists died in Jenin, and so members of Islamic Jihad were angry with Arafat. They stated he didn't do enough to defend them and that they made sacrifices for the Palestinian cause while the PA did not. 2 weeks after the terrorists were jailed in Jericho, the Palestinian High Court ordered the release of the leader of the PFLP. Israel was livid. Israel promised to bring justice to him if he was released. Subsequently, the PA overruled the High Court and kept the PFLP commander behind bars because of Israeli threats. Operation Protective Wall was one element providing a necessary pressure for change. On April 5th, Israeli forces killed the mastermind of the Passover massacre. The leader, Qais Oduwan, headed the military wing of Hamas in northern Samaria. On April 15, 2002, the IDF captured Marwan Barghouti, the Tanzim commander in the West Bank. He was considered the natural successor to Arafat. Israel holds him responsible for the Al-Aqsa Intifada and for attacks on Israelis. The IDF initially thought that he was hiding in Arafat's Ramallah compound. After seizing the compound, the Israelis discovered that he was on the run. Eventually, they tracked him down to a building close to Arafat's headquarters. The IDF surrounded the building, and Barghouti surrendered without a fight. Big, tough, sacrificial terrorist, isn't he? He surrendered without a fight, and then, under interrogation, Barghouti admitted to IDF forces that he directed terrorist attacks in which scores of Israelis were killed. He also revealed how he allocated the needed funds for the terror cells and purchased the necessary weapons. Now, the arrest of Barghouti and other top-level Fatah activists and hundreds of rank-and-file Fatah activists produced information directly linking Arafat with terrorism. These statements are supported by a vast number of documents seized from the PA offices. For example, those requiring financial support needed to have their request authorized by Arafat personally. Also, the names of potential Tanzim activists were submitted to Barghouti, who then took them to Arafat for approval. All right, let's move to April 2002, April 2nd, and the Bethlehem siege. On April 2, 2002, Israeli tanks and troops rolled into Bethlehem as part of Operation Protective Wall. In response, some 200 Palestinians, many of them armed, stormed the famous Church of the Nativity. Now, here is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. This is Manger Square. And this is the interior of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. So the army besieged them for 39 days. This standoff between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian militants is at this well-known holy site captured the world's attention. Entering the compound is an old practice of Palestinian militants because they know that the IDF is under orders not to harm holy places. Places of worship are offered special protection in accordance with international law. This action by the terrorists is a direct violation of the Geneva Conventions and its additional protocols. Israel demanded that the militants either surrendered or be tried in an Israeli military court, or be expelled from the country forever. The siege was prolonged as various European countries refused to accept the terrorists. They didn't want these guys either. Eventually, 13 militants were exiled to Cyprus and 26 sent to the Gaza Strip. Residents of Bethlehem were relieved, stating that these men had imposed a 2-year reign of terror in the city that included rape, extortion, and executions. The next day, April 3, 2002, the Jenin refugee camp was invaded and Israel was accused of a massacre. The Israeli tanks rolled into Jenin as part of Operation Defensive Shield. They encountered stiff resistance in this bastion of terrorism and this breeding ground for suicide bombers. Many of the militants were associated with Islamic Jihad. And here is the Jenin refugee camp in the north of the West Bank. Now, this is a map of Jenin in the yellow box, and the refugee camp is this small section on the western side of Jenin. And the IDF army entered in this location, and this is where they encountered very stiff resistance. The IDF encountered booby trap buildings, and booby-trapped alleyways, booby-trapped bodies. A typical situation the soldiers encountered would be to approach a three-story building. The door and the first floor would be blanketed with booby traps. On the second floor, the soldiers would find a couple of civilian families, usually around 12 or so, who were effectively barricaded in by the booby traps. They couldn't get out of the building. Then on the third floor would be about five terrorists who would be shooting down at the soldiers. So they had provided themselves with two layers of defense. First layer was booby traps. The second layer was civilians. Palestinian media began producing allegations concerning IDF interference. Interference with sick, with wounded, with the dead, systematic destruction of houses, and a massacre in Jenin. In contrast, the IDF continued its policy of providing humanitarian aid as well as food, water, and medicine to civilians on the West Bank and Gaza. On April 12, 2002, the United States Secretary of State, Colin Powell, stated that Israel had a right to defend itself. He stated, "We have responded to terrorism. We know that Israel has a right to respond to terrorism." On the seventh day of the operation, a platoon of Israeli soldiers from the 5th Brigade were ambushed in a plaza. Almost the entire platoon was wiped out during the two-hour fight, with 13 killed and 6 wounded. And here is again a map of Jenin, and this is the area in which this platoon was so heavily attacked. The ambush proved to the IDF that the militants holed up in the surrounding buildings could only be extracted with a great loss of life. At that moment, they changed their tactics. Foot patrols and house-to-house searches were discontinued. Instead, armored bulldozers were brought in. Here's a picture of one of those armored bulldozers. They were brought in and used to crush any home believed to be the source of enemy fire. And they were effective. Here's a picture of Jenin, the aftermath. They would level any building in which terrorists were fighting. The incursion lasted until April 19, 2002, when Israeli forces completed their withdrawal from Jenin. President Bush praised Prime Minister Sharon for meeting the timetable for withdrawal that he had set. Arafat's lack of desire to halt terrorism was highlighted by the fact that the Israeli government had presented U.S. Peace Envoy Anthony Zinni with a list of 33 most wanted terrorists in December of 2001, 4 months earlier. The list was subsequently given by Zinni to the Palestinians, and these men were not arrested or detained. As a result, five of Israel's most wanted terrorists were arrested during Operation Defensive Shield, and three had been killed. Israel stated that about 70 Palestinians, most of them gunmen, were killed in Jenin. Now, on April 15, 2002, the initial Palestinian claim was that Israel had perpetrated a massacre with hundreds killed, including many civilians. On April 30th, the Palestinians had claimed that 3,000 had been killed. In order to substantiate that claim, the Palestinians began adding bodies to the mass grave that contained the bodies of 26 people who had been killed during the incursion. Where did they get the bodies? They removed them from a local cemetery to plant them in the mass grave. In addition, the IDF also caught a staged burial on film. A drone filmed a group of Palestinians carrying a body on a stretcher. The burial was being filmed by a Palestinian cameraman. The stretcher bearer stumbled and the body fell to the ground. Then the body got up and returned to the stretcher. After a second fall, the corpse walked off in a huff. On May 1, 2002, the American Human Rights Group, Physicians for Human Rights, released a report stating the evidence did not point to a massacre. The death toll was finally determined to be 7 civilians and 48 terrorists, 55 Palestinians, while Israel suffered 29 dead and 127 wounded. The UN did investigate the Jenin operation in response to false Palestinian propaganda regarding Israel's alleged massacre. In August, the resulting Secretary General's report overwhelmingly negated the Palestinian fabrication. Here's a picture of Kofi Hanan reporting to Yasser Arafat. He says, "I'm sorry, there was no massacre in Jenin." And Arafat then answered, as usual, the UN favors Israel. And if you know, of course, the bias against Israel in the UN, you'll find that humorous. The report specifically refutes the claim made by senior Palestinian Authority officials alleging the massacre of 500 civilians. The UN report stated that no more than 52 people died in Jenin, most of them armed individuals. Excuse me. Excuse me. I'd like to discuss an article called The Question of Blood, written by Dan Gordon, that appeared in the Jewish Journal May 29, 2002. Now, Dan Gordon is a former sergeant in the IDF. He's the author of 5 books, and he's a screenwriter. He was in Jenin on April 16th and was told a story by Dr. David Zangen, the chief medical officer of the Israeli paratroop unit that bore the brunt of the fighting in Jenin. Dr. Zangen said that the IDF not only worked to keep the Palestinian hospital opened, they offered the Palestinians blood for their wounded, and the Palestinians refused because it was Jewish blood. Now, the Israelis, who could not have been faulted for saying, well, you don't like it, I guess you'll have to do without, instead flew in 2,000 units of blood from Jordan via helicopters. So now we have Arab blood on hand. In addition, they saw to it that 40 units of blood from the Mukassad Hospital in East Jerusalem went to the hospital in Ramallah, and that 70 units got to the hospital in Tul Karem. And on top of that, they facilitated the delivery of 1,800 units of anticoagulants that had come from Morocco. The information was later confirmed by Colonel Arik Gordon of the IDF Office of Military Spokesman, who supplied the exact number of units and the names of the hospitals in which they were delivered. Dan Gordon concludes his article with these comments. He said, "So the question to ponder is, how do you negotiate with a hatred so great that it will refuse to accept your blood even to save its own people's lives? How do you negotiate with that? And secondly, why does an international community, speaking of the UN, vilify a nation that offers its own blood to its enemies while its own soldiers lay dying, and that, when faced with a race hatred that brands their blood unfit, diverts military flights to bring blood more suitable to the taste of those who would destroy them? Why does the international community act the way they act, and why is Israel vilified?" Well, Arafat was weakened by Operation Defensive Shield, and he promotes a PA reform. Yasser Arafat and the PA, badly weakened by Operation Defensive Shield, came under pressure from the international community to reform. Moderate Arab states such as Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia began to see Arafat as the problem, not the solution, and are pressing for reform. Arafat also faced unprecedented domestic criticism. Operation Defensive Shield caused additional economic hardship for the Palestinian Arabs. Dissatisfaction with Arafat became more and more visible. Early in July, a significant demonstration occurred. The demonstration involved approximately 10,000 Palestinians. They demonstrated in Gaza, blaming the PA for disastrous economic situations rather than Israel. At one point, about 4,000 began marching toward Arafat's offices, but were stopped by the PA police. More and more PA officials began talking about lost opportunities, about a normal life, and about a desire to change direction. Fatah demanded that he appoint a prime minister to handle the day-to-day affairs of the state. Arafat would remain the symbol of the Palestinian cause, but would no longer be the only one calling the shots. Accordingly, on Nakba Day 2002, he called for sweeping reforms of his government and for new elections. The new elections were scheduled for mid-January of 2003. But his government reforms were less than sweeping. He trimmed his cabinet from 32 ministers to 21. And here's a cartoon speaking to that shakeup of the government. Before the shakeup, there were 32 Arafat clones in the government. After the shakeup, there were 21 Arafat clones in the government. Two significant changes did occur, however. Arafat stepped down as interior ministry, and he appointed a new interior minister who will oversee Palestinian security forces, removing Jabril Rajoub from that position. So here's Jabril Rajoub. A behind-the-scenes power struggle between Jabril Rajoub and Mohammed Dahlan, the Gaza security chief, appeared. A supporter of Rajoub's rival was beaten by five masked men outside his Ramallah home. Arafat's dismissal of Rajoub threw the PA into turmoil. In addition, Palestinian police chief Ghazi al-Yabali in Gaza has decided to run against Arafat in the January election. The fact that a senior Palestinian is willing to run against Arafat is another indicator that Arafat's hold on power is slipping. All right, April 17, 2002, Israel's 54th Independence Day. The current population is 6.5 million, eight times larger than in 1948. Jewish population, 81%, 5.2 million. Arab population, 19%, 1.2 million. And 2.9 million immigrants have come in since 1948. Israel, at this time, in 2002, accounts for 37% of worldwide Jewish population. The U.S. in 2002 is still the largest worldwide population center for Jewish people at 40%. June 17, 2002, the 34th Zionist Congress meets in Jerusalem, and as the 34th Zionist Congress gathered, a poll indicates that the majority of Palestinians favor the destruction of the State of Israel. 51% favor liberating all of historic Palestine. 71% supported terrorist attacks against civilians, and 48% supported attacks inside of Israel. So Israel does not have a peace partner. Israel subsequently begins building a security fence. Israel decided to build a 217-mile fence designed to shield it from suicide bombers. Now here's a map of the separation wall in 2003. The yellow area is the Palestinian territory. The green area is Israeli territory. Palestinian enclaves are in red, and the path of the wall is the dotted and solid blue line running around the outside of the territory. Arafat rejected the fence, calling it fascist and apartheid. The fence is meant to provide security, not form a border. It will consist of fences, walls, ditches, patrol roads, and electronic surveillance devices. In 2011, this was the status of the fence in red. It had just about encircled all of the West Bank. It will cost $200 million. It was expected to be completed in less than a year. The United States also criticized the decision. Immediately, the fence came under attack by gunmen south of Afula. There was no damage or casualties, and construction was only temporarily halted. In addition, a 30-mile-long electronic fence is also going up. The fence will protect three sides of Jerusalem with the aim of keeping suicide bombers out of the city. Now, here's some photographs of this security fence. 97% of the security fence is chain link. You can see that chain link fence here. 97% of the fence is constructed of chain link fence and border roads and patrol roads. Now, only 3% of the security fence is a concrete wall, a large concrete wall, as you see in this picture. Now, why does Israel need to put a concrete wall on 3% of its security fence? Well, the reason lies in that the concrete wall is provides sniper protection. As you can see in this drawing, the wall provides a bullet shadow, a sniper shadow, for cars traveling along the road at its base. So that's why the high concrete walls have been created, for sniper protection. But they also provide a nice palette for Palestinian propaganda. And on the Palestinian side of the wall, you see many, many drawings such as this one. But remember, this is only 3% of the security wall. I think it gets about 99% of the media coverage, however. And this so it makes it look like the Palestinians are behind another Berlin Wall, which is totally untrue. Again, here is the fence. It's a security fence made of ditches, patrol roads, barbed wire, and sensors. That's 97% of the fence. Now here in this picture, you can see part of the barbed wire that makes up the security fence on the right-hand side of the photograph. So Israel begins building this security fence. And in the years to come, even though the fence was highly criticized, the value of the security fence was clearly demonstrated. Israeli government sources have stated that since the barrier had been built, Israeli security has improved with regard to suicide bombings. According to statistics published by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Israeli Security Agency, from the beginning of the Second Intifada until the construction of the first continuous segment of the barrier in July 2003, 73 Palestinian suicide bombings were carried out from the West Bank, killing 293 Israelis and injuring over 1,900. However, between August 2003 and the end of 2006, only 12 attacks were carried out based from the West Bank, killing 64 Israelis and wounding 445. The trend continued in 2007 and 2008 as well. The number of fatalities due to terrorist attacks have continued to exhibit steady decline since 2002, from 452 in 2002 to 9 in 2010. And this chart illustrates these statistics. As the West Bank barrier was completed, attacks went down. Suicide and bomb attacks in 2002, 59. Suicide and bomb attacks in 2003, 25, just about cut in half. Attacks in 2004, 14. Again, pretty much a 50% reduction. 2005, 7. Again, about a 50% reduction. 2006, 4. 2007, 1. 2008, 1 terror attack. And according to this chart, in 2009, when this chart had been drawn, there had been 0 suicide attacks. In other words, the separation wall has been very, very successful. In June 24, 2002, Operation Determined Path was begun. In mid-June, a wave of suicide attacks killed 30 Israelis. In response, Israel launched a new operation dubbed Determined Path. Coordinated with Operation Determined Path came a significant change in Israeli strategy. Israel will now respond to acts of terror by capturing PA territory. The territory will be held as long as terror continues, and more attacks will lead to Israel taking more territory. Now, the change was not without criticism. A long-term reoccupation of territory means Israel becomes responsible for everything from health to sewage. Such a responsibility would pose an incredible burden upon Israel. Now, Yasser Arafat fruitlessly called for an end to terror attacks and asked that President Bush implement the end of the Madrid conference. The remarks were not made on TV or radio, but so had limited exposure. Arafat also announced that he was willing to accept the December 2000 Camp David Clinton peace plan, in which 95% of the West Bank was offered to the PA. Now, all of a sudden, he's quite willing to accept these offers when he wasn't back in 2000. In addition, the PA announced that presidential and parliamentary elections would be held in mid-January of 2003. That never happened. Instead of a warm welcome for his turnabout, President Bush urged the Palestinians to replace Yasser Arafat and adopt a practicing democracy leading to an independent state within 3 years. Bush replaced the land for peace doctrine of the last 35 years with a democracy for statehood doctrine. President Bush's statement was flatly rejected by the Palestinian leadership. They didn't want to give up any of their power. Yasser Arafat even denied that he was the man in question. He's not talking about replacing me. I should not be replaced. Me, of all people? The Arab world reacted with official silences from governments and expressions of outrage from the Arab media. July 2002, the founder of Hamas's military wing is assassinated. An Israeli warplane fired a missile that flattened a Gaza City apartment building, killing Saleh Shehadeh, the founder and top commander of the Hamas military wing. The wing, known as the Izzaddin al-Qassem, has carried out the largest number of suicide attacks against Israelis during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Israeli security forces describe Shahadeh as a deeply religious man, a fervent supporter of suicide bombings, and a possible successor to Ahmed Yassin. The attack killed 14 other Palestinians, including some children. Israel does all it can to avoid civilian casualties, as evidenced by the fact that this was the first fatalities in such a high toll, in an incident with such a high toll, in 22 months of fighting. This was a very unusual occurrence. In contrast to Palestinian attitudes, the Israeli army immediately opened an investigation to find out what went wrong. The operation was approved only after intelligence information indicated that no civilians were in the area. So this was a tragic mistake. But of course, those do happen. September 2002, Israel is winning the Al-Aqsa Intifada. By September 2002, the momentum of the Al-Aqsa Intifada had turned in Israel's favor. The intended effect of the Intifada was to demoralize the nation, to demoralize the state of Israel. However, it had done just the opposite. The nation of Israel was experiencing a sense of resolve and unity, the likes of which it had not known in decades. In contrast, the Palestinians' own violence was causing them to suffer, to lose ground, and to have doubts for three reasons. Number one, Palestinian impoverishment. Huge economic losses have been suffered with unemployment variously estimated at between 40 and 70%. Palestinian depression. The violence ended normal life in the West Bank and Gaza. Hospitals are closed. Transportation barely moves. Schools are shut. Life has ground to a halt. Number three, Palestinian recruitment woes. Israeli terrorism countermeasures are effective. Less and less people are being recruited as suicide bombers. The terrorism is not working. It takes a toll of the Palestinians without having its intended effect on Israel. Support for Yasser Arafat has fallen to a record low. Only 34% support him. Former supporters hold him responsible for the state of chaos and corruption found in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Arafat's biggest blow came when the Palestinian cabinet resigned, refusing to endorse Arafat's cabinet as inefficient and corrupt. Jibril Rajoub, the fired security chief, was particularly vocal with his criticisms. Severe criticism focused on Arafat's personal wealth, estimated at 1.3 billion. No, I did not say million. I did not use an M there. I used a B. $1.3 billion. Israeli sources stated that in July, Arafat transferred $5 million to his wife in Paris. The funds were provided by Saudi Arabia for assistance to the Palestinian people. Other leading Palestinians have transferred tens of millions to private bank accounts abroad as fears grow that the PA would collapse. The second-ranking PA official, Abu Mazan, and here's Abu Mazan, also known as Mahmoud Abbas, channeled $70 million in PA funds to European banks through his brother. Reports of these transfers have been reported through Arabic newspapers as well. However, after a six-week lull in homicide bombings, a tribute to the effectiveness of the Israeli countermeasures, two terrorists struck in northern Israel and in Tel Aviv. In response, the Israeli army besieged Arafat's compound in Ramallah, once again, and destroyed every building except the one housing Arafat himself. The army demanded the arrest of 19 men sheltered in the compound. After 11 days, President Bush demanded an end to the siege in order to gain support for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Israel agreed and lifted the siege. Analysts stated that Israel's strategy to isolate Arafat backfired. The siege sparked pro-Arafat demonstrations and revived his image as the symbol of Palestinian suffering and resistance. And now we come to one of the most important articles in this whole study. November 2002, Pastor Bob Morris of the Hadabar Messianic Ministry spends 3 weeks in Israel volunteering with the IDF Medical Corps. The world's media does not notice. Well, here's a picture of, here I am in Israel in my IDF uniform. I volunteered and was assigned to the IDF Medical Corps base. Here is our SAR-L group, the group I went over with in November of 2002. We're standing in our volunteer area, in our barracks area. This is our Madrika, Mary Siegel, a great young lady. We enjoyed Mary's leadership. And this is our Madrik, Boris Schindler. These two young people were great fun to be with, and we really enjoyed all they did for us. Thanks, Boris, and thanks, Mary. Accommodations were military basic in our barracks, as you can see, just basic accommodations. And here I'm with two other fellows, two others on the team, in one of the warehouses, posing with our supervisor, Mashiach. Mashiach there's in the front. In this particular warehouse, we were packing a Ringer solution, which is a kind of an artificial blood to be used on the battlefield if needed. Now, Mashiach could hardly speak any English, but we had a great time. We got along very well. It was a great fun working for him. Here is another picture of the warehouse, and this time we are packing pallets of medical supplies, various different sorts of medical supplies bound for the field. And I work with this fellow, I forget his name now, I work for this fellow for a couple of days, sterilizing surgical instruments for the IDF surgeons, so they would be ready if needed for medical surgical needs for the IDF soldiers that have been wounded. All right, November 2002, Abba Eban dies. Now, you're familiar with Abba Eban because he's the former Israeli foreign minister, and he is the host of the video series I hope you've been watching entitled Israel, a Nation is Born. He had a significant impact upon the history of Israel. Well, let's move to, here's Abba Eban's grave in Tel Aviv, in the Tel Aviv area. All right, let's move on to February 2003. We're in the year of 2003 now. And it began on a very sad note. Ilan Ramon, Israel's first astronaut, is killed in the space shuttle disaster. And the space shuttle disaster created all kinds of conspiracy theories for some reason. They swamped the internet. The Haaretz Hebrew Daily newspaper reports that anti-Semitic elements have been using the internet to spread rumors that the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster was caused by a secret Jewish-Israeli conspiracy of some sort. According to the smear campaign, Israeli astronaut Ilan Ramon joined the Columbia team as part of a secret attempt to gather intelligence information about Iraq, and the shuttle accident was staged by Israel and America to distract attention from the events in the Middle East. Very sinister, huh? A document released by the Anti-Defamation League states that, quote, Holocaust deniers on the net are making much of the fact that Ramon was the son of a Holocaust survivor and singled out his presence on the mission as evidence of Jewish or Israeli complicity in the disaster, suggesting his death was an intentional bid to gain sympathy for the Jewish state. Continuing the quote, shuttle conspiracy theories have surfaced in chat rooms, bulletin boards, email messages, and on websites frequented by extremists and anti-Semites, the ADL says. Now, why in the world would they pick on something like that and come up with such outlandish conspiracy theories? I have no idea. Totally unbelievable. But Israel is preparing, here is astronaut Ilan Ramon, who Israel lost in the shuttle disaster. Israel is preparing for a potential attack from Iraq with weapons of mass destruction. Now, the Iraq War was an armed conflict in Iraq that consisted of two phases. The first was an invasion of Iraq starting on the 20th of March 2003 by an invasion force led by the United States. During the run-up to the war, President Saddam Hussein threatened to attack Israel if its forces invaded his country. If forces invaded his country from the coalition forces. Israel responded by preparing the local population for an attack using chemical and biological warfare. And that's the reason I was there in Israel. I was part of that program to prepare the local population for an attack by chemical and biological weapons. The U.S. and its allies are now preparing a roadmap for peace. The roadmap for peace was a plan to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict proposed by the Quartet on the Middle East. The Quartet is the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. The principles of the plan, originally drafted by U.S. Foreign Service Officer Donald Blum, were first outlined by U.S. President George W. Bush in a speech on the 24th of June, 2002, in which he called for an independent Palestinian state living side by side with Israel in peace. A draft version from the Bush administration was published as early as the 14th of November, 2002. The final text was released on the 30th of April, 2003. But the process reached a deadlock early in Phase 1, and the plan was never implemented. Over and over and over again, peace plans never get implemented. March 10, 2003, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is appointed the new Palestinian Prime Minister. And again, we've seen him before, Mahmoud Abbas. This is Abu Mazen. Remember, he channeled $70 million into European banks through his brother. April 30th, 2003, the roadmap is officially delivered to Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. May 23rd, 2003, Ariel Sharon officially accepts the roadmap. The White House officials acknowledged Israel's concern about the content of the roadmap, but Ariel Sharon decided to accept it. The New York Times writes on May 26, a few days later, in the face of withering criticism from his own right-wing party, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon staunchly defended his support for the latest Mideast peace effort today, declaring that, quote, ruling 3.5 million Palestinians cannot go on indefinitely. So I think Ariel Sharon probably hit it right on the nose there. September 6, 2003, Mahmoud Abbas resigns as Palestinian Prime Minister. September 7, 2003, Ahmed Kureya, Abu Allah, is named Palestinian Prime Minister. And here's Ahmed Kureya. October 12, 2003, the Geneva Accord is finished. The Geneva Initiative, also known as the Geneva Accord, is a draft, not a final, but a draft status agreement, permanent status agreement, to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on previous official negotiations, such as the international resolutions, the Quartet Roadmap, the Clinton Parameters, and the Arab Peace Initiative. You know, if the Palestinians wanted peace, it would have happened long ago. This peace process has been going on for years, and yet nothing is resolved. So this document was finished on the 12th of October, 2003. October 23, 2003, a plan to remove Arafat surfaces. This is from news from Jerusalem, Israel Today. The Israeli army has drawn up a plan to implement the cabinet's decision to remove Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, according to a report in the English language daily Jerusalem Post. Quote, we have presented plans showing the risks and chances of the operation itself, including the options to remove him alive or not, the paper quoted a senior military source as saying. Quote, the government has to make a decision to allow the army to act, and the army is ready, unquote. But the army did not comment on the report. Palestinian officials said if that Arafat is removed, it would kill the peace process and lead to anarchy in the territories. Kill the peace process that was not alive to begin with. All right, November 30th, 2003, opposition to the Geneva Accord surfaces. Four key Palestinian negotiators of this symbolic peace agreement, it was not a final status agreement, it was simply symbolic, have decided not to attend the signing ceremony tomorrow in Switzerland. This is a blow to Israeli architects of the deal, led by Ultradove and also architect Yossi Beilin. Their absence clearly undermines the Geneva Accord, which calls for Israel to give up all Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, and hand the Temple Mount over to the Palestinians. In exchange, the Palestinians would give up the so-called right of return of millions of refugees and their descendants to their former homes in Israel. But the Geneva Accord has run into strong opposition on the militant Palestinian street. And Yasser Arafat refused to endorse the deal in writing, a symbolic deal. He even refuses to endorse that. Gunmen even fired shots at the Ramallah home of the chief Palestinian negotiator Yasser Abdel Rabo, who is also a cabinet minister. Hence, the four Palestinian negotiators dropped out. Why? Because they were threatened by their own peace-loving people. December 1st, 2003, the Geneva Accords are signed, outlining a draft of permanent status agreements. The Geneva Accord did not pave a way for the formal peace agreement. It was all wishful thinking. December 18th, Sharon announces in the intent of unilateral disengagement. And I think I'm out of time right now. And let's wait. Yes, I'm out of time. So we'll pick it up in 2004 with the fact that the White House accepts the idea of unilateral disengagement. So we'll pick it up next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you then.